How's it going, everyone? Welcome back to the Young Wealth Podcast. If you're new here, I'm your host, Ethan Lang. Before we get into today's episode, hit that follow button or subscribe button dependent on which platform you're listening to this on. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, consider leaving a 5-star rating and review. Thank you all so much for tuning into today's episode. Let's bring on our guest and dive straight in. I hope you all enjoy. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to yet another episode of the Young Wealth Podcast. For the first time, I actually have two guests on. Their names are Josh and Allie, but together they make the Financial Independence Couple, also known as the FI Couple. So let's give them a warm welcome onto the show. How are you guys both doing?
We're doing awesome. We're so excited to be chatting with you tonight.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us, Ethan.
Yeah, no problem. And I'm super excited to get into it. And there's a lot of things I want to talk about specific areas. So I want to get into your story first and kind of talk not too far back, but what really got you into personal finance? Was there any books? Were there any things that just like kind of changed your mindset and that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So it was actually probably about 3 or 4 years ago. Allie was getting ready to finish up her master's degree. I was working in my career, and we kind of started to calculate how much student loan debt that we had accumulated. It wasn't really a number that we had thought much about. And we realized it was over $100,000. We hadn't really talked about it up until that point. And so we wanted to start learning how we could, frankly, not have $100,000 of student loans. And that's kind of where our relationship with personal finance began.
And prior to that, we were not having money conversations. We were not thinking about money. We were not thinking about our spending. We didn't have friends that were talking about it. It was just kind of like, well, everyone has student loans and everyone has debt. So that's kind of our start.
So did that happen before you were married? Was this when you were married? And that kind of stuff. Did you ever get into personal finance before you guys were together? Or was it something like after you guys were together, like, oh, well, we might need to figure this out? Was it kind of like that?
So we started dating in 2013. And the time frame that Josh is talking about where we had the scary reality of our student loans, that was probably 2017. So we had been together for a long time. We were engaged. We were not talking about money. And then the year of our wedding, 2018. We're like, this is our year. Allie is finally full-time employed and not a broke grad student. We're going to pull our finances together. And then 2 weeks into the year, Josh totaled his car and got laid off from a long-term employer of 7 years.
Yeah. It was not the best start to the year. Especially because we knew we still had a wedding 7 months from me getting fired. Mm-hmm. So it kind of sent us into a tailspin for a little bit. But luckily, we had started learning about personal finance. The first book we ever read was The Total Money Makeover by Dave Ramsey. So we kind of started learning the basics of a little bit, started making progress, and then starting in 2018, things got a little hairy there.
But I think through like the chaos of Josh getting fired and having a car accident and all of these things, it really motivated us more than ever because we realized the risk of having a single job, and now that job is gone. So now we're super leveraged, and how are we going to pay our bills? So Josh went down the rabbit hole of personal finance. It started with Dave Ramsey, but then it evolved to all things real estate. We got into Bigger Pockets. Josh read Set for Life by Scott Trench and fell in love a little bit. Yeah. And from there, it was just like super obsessed with all things real estate and personal finance.
Well, Josh, I'm going to say Set for Life is actually my favorite personal finance book that I've ever read. So I'm agreeing with you on that one. So was that kind of your start? You guys really just wanted to pay off your student loan debt. It started with Dave Ramsey, and then it grew into, like you said, some of the Set for Life, Bigger Pockets, that type of stuff.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we tried the Dave Ramsey kind of rice and beans and rice kind of approach, and didn't last very long, frankly. And so we were feeling pretty burnt out, and we were like, what's a better way to go about doing it? And just through a funny way of getting a hand, my hands on a, the book, I found Set for Life, and that was actually the first time I discovered the concept of house hacking. And just the math of it, you know, our largest expense was a luxury apartment that we were living in. And so I was like, well, neither one of us really have the ability to increase our income. So what's the fastest way we could lower our expenses? And that was housing and the car payments that we had.
And I think when we first like got started on this journey, it was very one-dimensional of we want to pay off our student loans. That's all it is. Like we have this mountain of debt. We want to get rid of it A to B. This is what we want to do. But the more we learned, the more we realized, hey, there are a lot of opportunities if you get your finances in order. Do we want to work for the next 30 years? Do we want more flexibility? Do we want our lives to look different? So I think it's really evolved from the beginning for sure.
Come a long way.
Yeah.
And is that kind of what transferred is when you saw, you know, what house hacking, what some of these other investments could do that kind of just motivated you besides, because I can see from the outside, I've never had debt. So I don't know exactly what that feeling is like, but I bet it's a little bit of a drag to just be paying off debt every month. Like there's not that excitement that you get in your body to like, we're going to make it versus, you know, some of these other approaches where you're really looking at the big picture and you're like, well, if I can do all these things, then, you know, money's going to become easy for me in the future. Can you explain a little bit more about house hacking, you know, your first house hack, what that kind of was like?
Yeah. So for those that aren't familiar, house hacking is a concept where you purchase a property using a owner-occupant loan. This means you're going to live there. And when you live there, you qualify for a loan that could be as little as 0% down if you're a veteran or 3.5% or 5% down for someone else. So you put very little money down. You either purchase a single family home or a multifamily home. If you buy a single family home, you would rent out the rooms and the rent that you collect every month would pay for your mortgage so that you don't have to or you're paying very little. If you buy a duplex like what we did, that's a two family home. We lived in one side, we had a tenant on the other side, and their rent paid for the majority of the mortgage. So now again, you're investing in real estate and your housing costs is radically reduced. So you live for cheap.
And the power of that was, you know, when we really started understanding not just debt as far as the number, but really the impact it was having on us. I mean, we were both working a ton of hours before I got fired. We weren't spending a whole lot of time together leading up to our marriage. And we were realizing just keeping that debt around was going to, frankly, force us to trade more and more of our time for money just so that we could pay off the debt. And it wasn't going to give us as much to do the things that we really liked or loved. And that's where house hacking felt like a no-brainer.
Yeah, because the amount of money that you were able to save out of your largest expense could then now go to debt without you making an extra dollar at all. And I think that's why it's so powerful because, you know, you're eliminating your largest expense while putting equity into a home. And, you know, for some people, some house hacks, they're even making cash flow on top of that. So it is even increasing their income. But for you guys, you know, investing in index funds or some of these other things is, you know, like really a simple process. You're going to put money in every single month. But for house hacking, it's a little bit more daunting for most people. Even for me, I've read all these books, talked to a ton of people who've already had success in doing it, but there's still that little bit of fear factor in it. Was it really scary for you at first, you know, getting into house hacking? What was your biggest, you know, fear going into it? And how'd you guys kind of work through that?
I think it was terrifying. Josh was definitely the one that like researched more and read the books and talked to people. And it took a little longer to get me on board. And I think when you are not educating yourself or you're not surrounding yourself with people that are doing it, it seems like this crazy foreign concept. I never thought we'd be landlords in our life. I didn't think I could handle that level of responsibility. What if something breaks? What if someone sues us? What if like literally my brain was catastrophizing anything that could go wrong. It's going to happen. We're going to ruin our lives. But I think the reality is it's not so scary. We became homeowners, as millions of people do every day, and we needed a place to live, so we bought a house and it happened to have an apartment attached. So what does a regular person do if something breaks in their home? They fix it or they call someone to fix it. So I think people overcomplicate real estate investing. You certainly have to have systems in place. It's a business, but I think the way to overcome it is to just educate yourself and talk to other people that are doing it.
And it was huge for us just getting around people. And by getting around, no one in our real life was actually doing this. So by around, it was just
virtual network
and podcasts and books and YouTube and stuff like that and networking and stuff. And so, but the more we started talking to people who were doing it or had done it, the more normal it became and the more we realized that, yeah, it really isn't as complicated as I think sometimes our minds make it out to be. And once we started doing it and, we went to some houses that I'm glad we didn't buy because we learned a lot along the way. But once we got in, moved in, and we realized, we own a home and it just so happens someone else lives next door and pays us rent to do it.
Yeah, because I never really thought, I mean, it's pretty obvious, but it's the exact same thing that someone would do if they bought a home. You know, they're still buying the same property. It's just a lot less risk for the person that's house hacking because you're eliminating that expense.
Yeah. I was going to say one thing too is, and not, I mean, we have a lot of two family and three family properties by us, but you go to other markets and sometimes they just flat out don't exist or the ones that are there are just really, really expensive. And so we have a lot of friends who literally buy a standard single family home, but it has three or four bedrooms, right? So it's literally what most people would buy. And then they just rent out the bedrooms. And so house hacking can be as complicated or simple as it is, but it's just finding a way to take something that's for most people their largest expense and creating an asset or income stream out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's pretty awesome. I actually have a friend that I'm going to be living with probably within the next month that is house hacking right now. And nice. I said I'd live with him for the first year. And his isn't a traditional duplex. It's a single family home that, you know, was originally a single family home, but there's a door on the backside that just goes straight down to the basement. He was able to, you know, add a kitchen, add some of that stuff. So now he has two units and he's renting it out to a lot of his college friends. So, you know, it's huge. And the ability to be able to, like we said, eliminate your largest expense while all that cash flow that it frees up, you're able to do so many other things. So kind of going off of that, with that cash flow that you guys were able to gain, what was your next step? Was it paying off the debt? Was it trying to find another house hack? Was it some other type of investment? Can you maybe elaborate a little more on that?
Yeah, Josh and I kind of cycle because we have so many different goals and they're all pretty ambitious. We tend to like kind of chunk it out into like, you know, digestible goals that we focus on each quarter and then we transition to the next. So our first goal was let's reduce our expenses. And we did that through house hacking. So we were able to eliminate our rent payment. And in doing so, we were able to take a lot of money and throw them at our student loans. We went from, you know, in the past 2 years, we went from 100,000 in student loans to we're right about 40,000 now. So we paid off 60 grand in the past 2 years. And that has been hard work and commitment, but it's because we reduced our cost of living. But we've also worked to increase our incomes as well.
And like Allie said, is that along with eliminating debt, which has been a big priority for us, we did actually kind of one of our goals was we wanted to live for free because that would just give us that much more money. And so we bought our first house hack at the end of 2018. Paid off a lot of student loans all of 2019, learned real estate, continued to network and self-educate.
Put systems into place.
Yep. And then in 2020, we actually bought our second house hack, which helped us achieve that live for free goal.
Gotcha. So you're saying that both house hacks completely pay for all of your expenses?
Yep.
That's awesome.
All of our housing
expenses. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so that's been pretty cool. And in addition to that, you know, we have a very modest index fund portfolio, which mm-hmm. we plan to grow. But right now, our number one has just been the cash flow from real estate and living for free and then paying off this debt, which we plan to do by the beginning, middle of 2022.
Gotcha. So one of the things that was interesting, you kind of talked about index funds a little bit. Why is having an index fund portfolio, you know, in conjunction with your real estate investments really important to you? Because I'm on the side with you guys, but I know a lot of people that are either, you know, they're all real estate and that's all they own, or, you know, it's only, you know, stock side, stock market side, index funds, that type of stuff. Where do you guys kind of see that mix coming from, and why is that important to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of synergies between the two, and they're both incredibly strong asset classes with, you know, many, many years, centuries even, of positive track records. And so for us, real estate has been our primary focus just because, A, we can't really lower our cost of living with index funds necessarily. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And B, you know, a rental property is going to give you a lot more cash flow compared to an index fund, which is really more biased towards appreciation. Mm-hmm. You know, like the dividend on an index fund cash flow, if you will, is quite low, mm-hmm. but it appreciates much faster, whereas in real estate, you know, the appreciation normally, you know, right now things are kind of crazy, but normally doesn't really appreciate as much, but the cash flow is much higher. And so priority one for us was to continue to build up our rental portfolio and generate the cash flow, use the cash flow to help us eliminate student loans and pay for some of our cost of living. But we also wanted to make sure that we weren't all in real estate, because we also have a lot of mentors and friends in real estate who were investing back in 2008, mm-hmm. had all of their assets locked in real estate, and, you know, they kind of paid the price. So we've learned from them along the way.
And I think with Josh getting fired in 2018 again, it really like stressed the importance of diversification in terms of multiple streams of income and not just investing everything in a single job or a single type of investment. So for us, we're really big on, you know, what are the tried and true ways to build wealth, and it's index funds and real estate. So yeah, we're all about both of them.
So one of the things you said, you talked about diversifying, you know, your income sources. And I think with Josh losing his job, there's a lot of people that don't really build an emergency fund and don't think they need an emergency fund because they haven't gone through that yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in college, my expenses are fairly low. So, you know, at times I'm like, gosh, I don't need that big of an emergency fund. But as you can see, like, it does really change. What does that look like for you guys with your emergency fund, considering your expenses are a lot lower with house hacking and some of the other opportunities you guys are taking advantage of?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So admittedly, if you had talked to us a couple of years ago, I think we were a bit more conservative in terms of an emergency fund. And we felt like, you know, that standard 3 to 6 months was, you know, you had to have it kind of thing. And mm-hmm. at that time, you know, we didn't really know as much as we know now, and our savings rate wasn't what it was, and so on and so forth. And so that's kind of what we did. Today, our cash, we don't really see as much as an emergency fund as our savings rate and diversified income streams. You know, we gotcha. Keep maybe 1.5 months worth of cash in an emergency fund. But we also save upwards of 90% of our income now. So gotcha. We know that if, you know, and for instance, like my car needed a lot of work unexpectedly over the summer. And so we were able to cash flow all of it, not from an emergency fund, but just from...
We have such a surplus of income because we keep our expenses so low.
So that's our biggest emergency fund, if you will, is our high savings rate coupled with multiple streams of income. But when we were just starting out, absolutely, we felt that that cash was necessary because we were still building out everything that we have now.
It's also important to note that like creating an emergency fund that works for you is so specific to the situation. Right now, we both have pretty stable, non-volatile jobs. Mm-hmm. 2022, we're planning on going like full entrepreneurial. Yep. So yeah. That emergency fund is not going to be 1 month. It's going to be a lot higher. Sure. So I think depending on the season of life you're in and what your goals are short and long term, it's really going to influence like how much money you should have set aside.
Correct.
For sure, yeah. Because, I mean, when you go the entrepreneurial route, you know, it'll probably be great for you guys, but, you know, there's always that chance that we have another 2019, 2020 happen again, yeah. And you're going to have to pull a full 180. But, yeah, having that emergency fund, it was really interesting that you said because your savings rate is so high, you have to have less of an emergency fund. And typically when people think of 3 to 6 months, they think in their head that that means 3 to 6 months of income. And right. It is if you're spending 100% of your income,
right,
which is a lot of money. But when you have a 90% savings rate, that's really only about a month of income. So like you said, when your car needed work, you could just take it out of cash flow because you already had such a high savings rate. The next thing I kind of want to talk about is just marriage and money, how that comes together. And if you guys have had any problems, if you want to share, I just know that the number one cause of divorce is money issues. And I think that plays a huge role. And I'm not married at this point. I'm still in college. I'm a young guy, but I think it might be some stuff that I need to learn in the future. So what have been your guys' biggest struggles in regards to money? And then first we'll talk about that. And then maybe we can talk about some tips that you guys might have, you know, for couples trying to work on money together and kind of build out that future.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, it's something we talk about now every single day. So it's kind of like, it's like a muscle that you work every day. It just gets stronger and more resilient. So, but that wasn't always the case, especially like 2 or 3 years ago. I think one of the biggest things that we've had to learn along the way is that, frankly, it's not always about money. I think when we first started having conversations, I had the Excel sheets, I had the budget, and I was just ready to talk numbers. But there's a great book out there, Psychology of Money, and they talk about that about 80% of money isn't really money. It's emotion. It's mindset. Mm-hmm. And so when I first started talking with Allie about budgeting and finance and stuff, we weren't talking about values, things that we both really want to accomplish one day, what means the most to us. I was so focused on the numbers, and it wasn't really getting us anywhere. But then I think we started talking about our values and kind of how money and investments could allow us to do more of what we love and what matters most to us. And I think our conversations got a lot better from there.
And I think, you know, early on when you're in a relationship, we met in college. So like, you know, where you were, that's where I found my husband, right? So we met in college. And when you meet someone in college, I'm not thinking about what's their net worth and do they have debt? I'm thinking like, oh, he's really cute. And oh, he likes sushi too. Let's go on a sushi date. Like you think about like you have chemistry with someone, you like them, like they're fun to hang out with. And that's great. And that's important. But a marriage is a business relationship. You are legally binding yourself to someone and saying all of your life choices I'm going to have to live with because I'm tying that with you. So I think that we don't think about that when we first get into relationships. And I think that was a struggle for us because we had very different money values and spending values and all of that stuff. And, you know, you're an individual person, but once you form a partnership, it's like, damn, we have to make joint decisions together. Well, I don't agree with you right now and I don't want to do what you're doing. So I think there were a lot of growing pains. There were a lot of arguments. And I think that's life. But I think that we pushed through it and we've come to this place where, yeah, there's still growing pains and arguments, but it's a mutual respect. And it's knowing like we're in this together and we have to find a compromise. And that's life. Mm-hmm. So a suggestion going to the next part of the question, we always say one bed, one budget. I think there's couples that have separate finances and it works for them and that's fine, but we're huge on like total spending transparency. Like we have friends that are married that, you know, don't tell my husband I bought this or this is a secret purchase or no, like if it is above a certain monetary amount, we're going to talk about it. And I think just having that transparency, having those shared goals. And if you're early in dating and you're just getting to know someone, talk about money, talk about finances. It may not sound super sexy, but it's good to know and have those conversations.
Yeah.
So with that, two of the things that I thought was interesting, you know, first, I kind of have a question that goes along with it, but what are your tips for kind of talking through that? And then the second thing is that I thought was interesting about your point is you guys kind of talk about how you have this big plan and this big goal. And I think that probably helps you guys a lot because even when you have these little fights, you're still kind of on the same team. You're in that relationship and you see what you're both working towards. So it's easier to give that transparency to someone, you know, to the other person. But yeah, could you give some tips maybe on how to talk through those things? What have you realized that's been beneficial for you?
Yeah, I mean, those goals, first though, we have like dry erase boards all around our house sometimes. and those kind of give us like daily reminders of what our goals are. And not only our goals, but how much we've accomplished. Admittedly, 3 years ago, our, you know, the accomplishment side of our dry erase board wasn't all that much, frankly, or at least didn't feel like it. So a lot of the stuff that we were working towards at that point, it was just kind of speculative and stuff like that. You know, fast forward a couple of years and now we have a lot of accomplishments together, which then kind of reaffirms everything that we've been doing because we have kind of like that proof of concept. And so, you know, I would just say that as far as like a tip, I'm a big fan of begin with the end in mind. Stephen Covey, 7 Habits of Highly Successful People. Anytime I try to go into a conversation, I try not to just focus on what is the thing that I want to talk about. It's what's the goal, what's the desired outcome, and how can us having this conversation move us in the direction of that goal?
Okay. So in terms of like actual like action steps, I think early in a relationship, like if you're just starting out dating someone and having those conversations, I think transparency, just if you see it maybe progressing further, having conversations about like, are you a spender or are you a saver? What's your favorite thing to spend money on? What are things you value spending money on? I love buying clothes and I love buying food. Josh has an obsession with electronics. Yeah. So these are things I didn't know when I first started dating him. And now I get Amazon packages and he's like, oh, you're shopping again? So I think learning about someone's spending habits is huge. I would even say like having conversations about debt and about income, because when you marry someone, you're taking on their debt too. And if they have a really high income or a really low income, that's something that impacts your financial situation as well. So there's no perfect way to go about it, but I think just being transparent, and if you are at that level of being serious, I think those are definitely conversations you should be having.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things that Josh said, you kind of talked about, you know, you have the whiteboards of goals, and I'm kind of that same person. You know, I have so many goals and things I want to accomplish, but there's kind of an area that I've been learning about lately, and it's called destination addiction. Now, I knew I've done it quite a bit, but I've just heard the term recently. And basically what it is, you know, I'll be happy when, or, you know, I just, my girlfriend got me a camper, which is something I'm super excited. I love the outdoors and I'm fixing it up. And it's kind of that thing, well, oh yeah, I'm going to be like happy when this happens, or, you know, once I accomplish this goal, then I'll be happy or then I'll be fulfilled. How do you guys kind of manage that to where, you know, you have these big aspirations for the future, but you're also remembering to, you know, that you're in the present and that you don't want to just keep reaching for that next thing. And then you're 80 years old and you realize that you never took the time to just enjoy what you built.
So I love that phrase, destination addiction, so much. And I think that it really epitomizes where we were at a certain point in our journey, because we got so obsessed with when the debt is paid off and when we have an 8 to 10 unit portfolio and all of this stuff. We were making our lives miserable. We were depressed over like, oh, we still have $80,000 in student loans. We were so focused on not getting there yet that we were not enjoying our lives. We were really hard on ourselves, and everything that people say you shouldn't do, like that's what we were doing. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the pivotal turning point was that we stopped doing that though.
I don't know if there was like a singular moment other than just the fact of more of our conversations were just, wow, I'm feeling really burnt out. So I think that's really where we started to, instead of looking out at the year or 5 years from now, we really kind of started living quarter by quarter.
That helped.
Which definitely kind of truncated things a little bit. And then instead of being so focused on, you know, the pursuit of one day from now, it's, you know what, today we have today. And how can we make this a really good, productive day? What goals, we're very goal-oriented people, what goals do we have, but not a year from now, but what do we want to accomplish this quarter? And a big thing, too, is while, yes, obviously we still have our financial and our investing goals, I think we have a lot more personal goals now, both as individuals and in our relationship. And by doing so and having conversations about that, I think that actually kind of started centering us more, because sometimes to have a certain net worth or investment portfolio, those are things that are often many years from, or sometimes decades from now. And it's like, it's hard to really see a return on that time investment. But in terms of our health and wellness, there's things that you can start doing today and tomorrow, and reasonably within like a week or two, you can feel a noticeable change both physically and mentally. So I think shifting from yearly and five-year goals down to like quarter sprints, if you will, and then also focusing not just on our money goals, but also on our marriage and our personal goals kind of helped us be more present.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Because there's so many people that are like, you know, I want to be a millionaire, or I want to be able to do what I want when I want. And those are like super broad and they don't really mean anything. They're a lot of just like nothingness. And and you go your whole life trying to get that. And then you get there and you realize that it wasn't much better than what I currently have. And and it's tough to kind of find that in the finance space, because, you know, when you say that at first, people think you're like, oh, well, you just like don't care about money and you're not going to, you know, spend money right, and you're just going to go spend money wherever. But finding that middle ground between like, this is what we want to do in the future, but we've also got 40 years till we're going to get there, or 20 years or whatever it is, and we still want to enjoy that time, because why not be happy now? So before I go on to my last question, where can the listeners of this episode find you on social media, if you guys have a website, anything like that?
Yeah, awesome. So our main platform right now is Instagram. So you can find us by our Instagram handle at the FI couple, the FI couple. We also have a website, www.theficouple.com, and a Twitter.
Yeah. And so, and we're actually co-hosts of a More Than Money community. It's a private Discord community with over 200 members, and It's literally what it sounds like. Yes, we talk about real estate, stocks, investing, and stuff like that, but we also talk a lot about health, wellness, mental health, especially after the year that just took place. And so we don't just focus on money, but more so being financially sound. What can that give you more time, freedom to do? We're really proud of More Than Money, and we're hoping to continue to grow that.
That's awesome, guys. So for the last question, typically I only have one guest on. So the question is, you know, why is wealth building important to you? But I would like you guys to answer it each as individuals and why it's important to you, and then answer it together, like why it's important for you guys as a couple.
Yeah, I'll
start. Can I go first?
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I think I want to go first because maybe you have my answer. We talk about a lot that, you know, traditional life is you get a job and you work it for 30 years and, you know, you spend most of your time with your coworkers. You spend most of your time with people that you just meet at your work. But then the person that you're obsessed with and you want to marry, and then the children you have that you love so much, they get the nights and weekends. They get the scraps. And in the morning when I'm waking up and I'm grumpy that I have to go to work, and at night when I've had a hard day, I'm not the best version of myself. I'm like a truncated version of me. And it sucks that the people that I love the most get like not me at my best. They get the scraps. So I think wealth building is nothing about material things or money, because that is not us. It is about giving the people that I have chosen to spend my life with my life and my time. And I want that with him. I want that with our future babies. I want that with my parents and our families, and just giving my all to the people that I love.
Yeah. The people who mean the most to us, I think, deserve the most from us. And the last thing I would want to ever have happen is I miss out on something that's really, really important or life-changing because I'm at a job. And there is nothing wrong with loving your career. I'm not like anti-career or anything like that. I just know for me, there was a time in my life where, yeah, that was really, really important. And the universe kind of stepped in and said, you need a wake-up call. And ever since then, you know, time with Allie, time with family, and really time focusing on my health and well-being, I know if I take care of myself, it allows me to help others in a more meaningful way and have a bigger impact. And so wealth to me isn't even so much a monetary matter as it is. It's a time freedom and it's a greater sense of health and well-being. And that's really the primary focus.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, I think your guys' answers were pretty similar, so you might not even have to answer it together. But that was awesome. I really like those answers. That's kind of the question I always ask at the end of every episode, because I think it's unique to each person. And I really like to figure out why that is for each individual that comes on the show. But thank you guys so much for coming on today. Anyone listening, make sure to go follow them on Instagram. If you follow me on Instagram, you've probably seen a few of their posts on my page because I love the content they put out. So make sure to go follow them. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and have a great day.
Thank you so much. It's been awesome.
Thanks, Ethan.
All right. See you guys. Thank you all so much for listening. But before you click off this episode, make sure to hit that follow or subscribe button on this podcast so you never miss an episode when it's released. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts and you enjoyed what you heard, please consider giving a 5-star rating and review. And if you do end up leaving a review, DM me a screenshot on Instagram at RealEthanLang and I'll share it on my story as a thank you. If you have any questions about really anything from this episode or just something that's on your mind, reach out to me on Instagram at RealEthanLang by shooting me a DM and I will make sure to get back to you. If you've made it to this point, I just want to end this episode by saying thank you. Have a great day and hopefully I will see you for next week's episode.
The Young Wealth Podcast is hosted by Ethan Lang. The information provided by the host and guest is for informational purposes only and does not constitute financial, tax, investment, or legal advice. You are responsible for your own money and your own decisions. Information, content, or other materials created by Making Sense of Finance LLC do not constitute a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer by Making Sense of Finance and/or any third-party service provider to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments.